Beth West Theater to stage a production of Beethoven's only opera, Fidelio, at their home at the Walt Disney Hall. The chorus will be performed by the White Hands Choir, a group from Venezuela consisting of disabled children and young adults who sing as well as sign. The production pairs up a singer and a deaf actor to both inhabit the one role on stage. Having deaf actors perform alongside opera singers, however, has its challenges, not least of which is keeping up the rhythm of the music.
I think probably that there's a lot of tempo that I've been rehearsing. A lot of times when the singers hold the same word, but the next time they say that exact same word in the next few bars, they don't hold it as long. So trying to remember all of those is very difficult. So are they holding this for 4 beats or 2 beats? Or what word is this in this thing?
I feel like the challenge with opera is that it's very fluid and it's not repetitive. The tempos change throughout it, and night to night it even changes. The conductor, you know, kind of changes how he conducts things each night, and so that is something that is challenging.
The opera singers also give small cues to the actors, like opening a letter or sitting down or standing up, to keep them informed where they are in the piece. The deaf cast use theatrical ASL, or American Sign Language, in the production. DJ Kurse, the producer at the Deaf West Theater, says the performance is a little bit more poetic and a little bit more kind of picturesque.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
World Oats Day, Israel's days are numbered. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The main cause of crisis in West Asia is the cancerous tumor called Israel. The fabricated regime of Israel declared existence in 1948. The regime has continued crimes against the Palestinian nation ever since. Israel has made millions of Palestinians homeless and jailed thousands of them and martyred scores of thousands of others. The Zionist regime intensified its brutal attacks against the owners of the land since the notorious super criminal Ariel Sharon went to the state of coma. The fake regime keeps devastating the infrastructures of Palestine and bulldozing the homes and hearths of the people to make conditions insecure for them. Now, can the conscience of wakeful people keep silent? Palestine is the land in the world where human rights are violated round the clock. But the so-called defenders of human rights and international organizations have kept silent towards heinous crimes of the Zionist regime. The silence has emboldened Israel to continue killing of innocent people. Moreover, even if a resolution is ratified against the Zionist regime in the UN, the United States of America wields the law of jungle illegally called as veto rights and gives green light to the illegitimate regime in Tel Aviv to further murder Palestinian women and children and demolish their homes and hearts. Why should the U.S. give billions of dollars annually to Israel to kill Palestinians? Why should Washington aid and abet the fake regime with arms and equipment to massacre Palestinians? Why should Israel own the only atomic arsenal in West Asia? Which nation is it going to annihilate with those nuclear bombs? Why should Palestine be under the constant siege of the Zionist military? Why should the so-called international community turn a blind eye and deaf ear to this indescribable volume of crimes by the Zionist regime and force over 2 billion Muslims to tolerate Israel, which was born on crime and genocide? Are the Palestinians not allowed to even shout against the violation of all their rights? Shouldn't they take recourse to public uprising to defend their legitimate rights? While all global bodies are tacitly asleep against this much of crimes, there is no other choice for the Palestinian nation to show their wrath. While the Zionist and U.S.-controlled media do not want to distinguish between defenseless people and terrorists and call Palestinian children and youth as terrorists, why should the oppressed Palestinians do? The UN and its affiliated bodies are all puppets in the hands of the Zionist regime and its comrades in crime, especially the US. In 2006, the UN Security Council, in spite of the demand of the Lebanese government and the world people, refused to hold a mission to stop the Israeli attacks on Lebanon. This gave time to the criminal Israeli military to devastate all infrastructures of Lebanon and make over 1 million people homeless. Only when the Zionist regime announced that there is no military solution against Hezbollah, the UNSC issued a resolution, and that to further pressure Lebanon. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said the consecutive defeats of the American in Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, and Palestine indicate the might of the resistance front. This development has created changes in the political map of the region, has led to independence from the West, and has raised a promising Islamic view. Today, the axis of resistance has expanded from the Red Sea to the Mediterranean all through Ansarullah in Yemen to Hezbollah in Lebanon. The Lebanese Islamic resistance possesses great reserves of various kinds of short-range and medium-range missiles. These missiles are radar-evasive and pinpoint. Thus, the entire occupied territories are under the fire of these missiles, and this is why they have caused and unending nightmare for Israel. Hezbollah has also gained access to high capabilities in the field of drones, cyber war, and electronic war. These factors of power cause Israel to regret any aggression, as the response will be much more crushing than the previous ones. However, the world people, particularly Muslims, do not want to be mere onlookers of crimes and acts of terror by Israeli military against the Palestinian nation. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, anyone who wakes up while feeling no responsibility towards the affairs of Muslims is not a Muslim. Imam Khomeini, as the reviver and main supporter of the Palestinian cause, showed the Quranic view to all seekers of freedom and peace in the world. He declared the last Friday of the blessed month of Ramadan as the World Quds Day, to urge Muslims to defend the oppressed people of Palestine through demonstrations and rallies. Over four decades ago, when the world Muslims numbered more than 700 million, the Imam said, if each Muslim pours one bucket of water, Israel will be drowned. Imam Khomeini's initiative has made Muslims more united and has created a nightmare for the Zionist occupiers of Palestine and the first Qibla of Islam, the Holy Quds. It has breathed new spirit in the Palestinian cause and given hope to the young generation in Palestine to pursue their forgotten rights with no fear of losing their life. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The past week has seen repeated Zionist incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds. Worshippers have been refused access, locked in, assaulted, attacked, and arrested. The Jewish settlers who attacked worshippers and desecrated Al-Aqsa were protected by armed Zionist police and military personnel. And these outrages are occurring during the holy month of Ramadan, when Muslims traditionally flock to Al-Aqsa to pray. So in today's programme, we'll examine the response of the Palestinians to these events and look in depth at the state of the resistance to the Zionist colony. We'll also highlight the importance of Al-Quds Day, which is traditionally marked on the last Friday of Ramadan and is an important fixture in the international calendar of resistance. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. But first, we've got this special report by Latifa Abu Chakra on how Palestine resists occupation.
Palestinians have faced over 100 years of Zionist settler colonialism and resisted every step of the way. They have shown endless courage and fortitude and written their history in their blood, sweat and tears. But they have never been alone. From the 1936 rebellion against the British to today, the Palestinians have always had the hearts of millions. The Zionist entity has attacked every country it is near and has reportedly carried out assassinations in at least 18 different states. On a popular level, Zionism is a pariah. The arrogance of the Zionist entity is a fragile veneer over its increasing vulnerability. UN Resolution 3246 asserts that Palestinians have the right to liberate themselves from foreign occupation through armed struggle, and governments representing the vast majority of humanity do not prescribe the Palestinian resistance. Today, resistance forces are more united than ever. Over a million Palestinians live within the 1948 Zionist entity. During the 2021 battle of Saif al-Quds, they went on strike for one day, causing losses to the settler economy of over $40 million. On the same day, almost 1,000 Palestinian bus drivers went on strike, leading to the cancellation of 300 journeys in the entity. At the same time, resistance from Gaza had closed Ben Gurion Airport in occupied Jaffa. The situation became so desperate for the apartheid regime that the mayor of Lod called for the mobilization of the occupation forces in the city. Settlers abandoned their homes as the municipality completely lost control. Overall, the resistance caused the currency of the entity to fall and the economy to stagger. The other side of the equation has seen for the very first time the honorable resistance in Gaza, launching Russian-made 9K-32 Stellar to surface-to-air missiles at occupier fighter jets. Helicopters and drones are especially vulnerable. How long before one is caught and tumbles down into Gaza, the home of heroes? Even the head of Israeli intelligence has no security. Mossad chief David Barnea had his phone hacked and details of his taxes and wages published on Telegram by a group said to be close to the resistance. In the very same month, the websites of the Ministry of the Interior and others of the Israeli regime were hacked and taken down. It has also been reported that the Islamic Republic of Iran has sent pictures to the Israeli regime through intermediaries of the locations for all biological, chemical, and nuclear weapon storages that will be struck at the first military clash with the entity. The same account which reported this previously leaked the locations for all Israeli military bases across occupied Palestine. The resistance is closer than you think. The spider's web is more fragile than you could ever imagine.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative Spinwatch. We're also joined by Nora Barrows-Friedman. Nora is a staff writer and associate editor of the Electronic Intifada, the leading Palestine Solidarity News website. She's also the author of In Our Power, US Students Organize for Justice in Palestine. She joins us from California and recorded her contribution earlier. Welcome to the show. We started by asking Nora about the significance of the Al-Kurd family, who were active participants in the events in Sheikh Jarrah, and what that says about the new Palestinian resistance.
I think that's a wonderful question. And I feel like the convergence of so many factors here. We have, I mean, you know, youth have always been at the forefront of uprisings and rebellions and resistance in Palestine. But I think now, with the advent of social media and the ability for, you know, young activists like Mohammed and Muna to be able to just, you know, flip on their phone and live stream to the entire world what's happening on the ground right in front of their eyes, right in their backyard, I think has made solidarity with Palestinians much broader, and has really, I think, informed especially young people who see themselves in people like Mohammed and Muna, and so many other youth in Palestine, who are, you know, articulating the violence, the everyday violence of occupation, and are able to connect with other struggles against colonialism and imperialism and racism around the world.
David, how important do you think social media is in the battle for international opinion to secure the liberation of Palestine?
It's a two-part answer, this. Social media is important, and you can see the importance of social media by the fact that the Israelis spend a lot of time trying to monitor it and censor it. So that, for example, one of the members of the Facebook oversight board, Emmy Parmar, is a former Israeli intelligence operative who was in charge of the cyber security unit in the Israeli government, which was involved in taking down thousands and thousands of pages run by Palestinians and supporters of the Palestinians when she was in the government. And now she helps Facebook to decide which pages should be allowed to stay there, and indeed helps to decide which Palestinians should be arrested for incitement for things they've put on Facebook. So clearly the Israelis think that social media is important. But there's another sense in which social media isn't everything. It's not the whole of the resistance. The resistance has a cutting edge, and that is armed opposition to the settler entity. And it is that and the resistance, the daily resistance of the Palestinian people, which will provide the cutting edge for the liberation of Palestine. And at that stage, social media will play catch up, and we'll be following the victories of the liberation as it comes.
Well, we also asked Nora for her assessment of the positive developments that's come out of the confrontation between the Zionists and the resistance in May 2021.
It's always hard to talk about positive developments against the backdrop of, a vicious Israeli military assault, which lasted 11 days and killed, you know, more than 250 Palestinians, including dozens of children, flattened entire apartment buildings, media offices, critical infrastructure. However, you know, what we did see at the same time was an expansion of kind of this pan-Palestinian inside Palestine and in the diaspora, really rising up in unison. We saw, you know, people have called it the Unity Intifada that was sparked last May because of the violence that Israel meted out. And, you know, we saw Palestinians inside 48, inside historic Palestine, Palestinian citizens of Israel, rising up alongside Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza. And in the diaspora, we saw, you know, marches to the boundary between Lebanon and present-day Israel, and in Jordan as well, as well as, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, Palestinians, you know, people from every sort of background, you know, across the world, in Europe and in the U.S. And so I think that has ignited more of a momentum of global solidarity with Palestine and Palestinians and the struggle for liberation. And I think, you know, that has once again, you know, sparked real direct actions. We've seen these incredible direct actions in the UK, by people with Palestine Action who are literally putting their bodies on the line to shut down weapons factories, Israeli weapons factories, and I think that is you know, far overdue, those kinds of actions, and I think they're getting wonderful results, you know, real palpable material results, because of Israel's, you know, barbaric and serial attacks on Palestine.
David, just picking up this idea of a unity intifada, I mean, do you think there's a sort of axis of resistance emerging now?
I think the notion of unity intifada is an interesting and useful one, and we see that from last May, but also in the contemporary events, people probably will have seen on social media, that when the Israelis tried to arrest the father of one of the people they killed the other week, there was a resistance movement which blocked all access to Jenin and stopped the Israelis from arresting this guy. And that involves all of the different armed factions, as well as non-armed factions in Palestine. So Saraya, the Qassam Brigades, the PFLP, and indeed Palestinian Islamic Jihad. That's them all acting in unison. So that's a real indication of a unity in the resistance. And even some of the Fatah armed units have been joining in with this, which is quite extraordinary, given Fatah is largely collaborating with the Israelis. So there's a level of unity there which is new and which is extremely positive, I think, for the resistance. But when you use the phrase axis of resistance, I'm not sure people in the West really are familiar with that term. It doesn't mean necessarily an axis of resistance inside Palestine. It means, yes, the resistance in Palestine, all the different factions, but also the resistance to Western interests around, about Palestine. So it means the Iranians, it means Syria, it means Hezbollah in Lebanon, it means several of the units and the movements in Iraq, and indeed, of course, Ansar Allah in Yemen, fighting the Saudis and the UAE and the Americans in Yemen. So that is a self-conscious sense of a unity between all sorts of different movements, not just self-conscious, but a practical unity. So that last May, for example, there was a situation room in Beirut where the Palestinians, the Iranians, Hezbollah, and others were actually planning collectively what the resistance would do. Now that's a game changer for the ability of the Zionists to resist the liberation movement. And that's what we see now in all these leaks that have been coming about Israeli intelligence, about the sites of military bases. We see the ability of the Zionists to resist a possible uprising is becoming narrower and narrower. And that's what the axis of resistance means.
Mm. Well, lastly, we asked Nora for her thoughts on what's happening at Al-Aqsa right now and the implications of these events.
Yeah, once again, we see Israel violently provoking Palestinian worshippers during Ramadan. You know, it kind of illustrates how empowered the fanatical ultra right wing settler movement has been in the last few years. You know, headed by the Israeli member of Knesset, Itamar Ben-Gvir, this latest kind of settler incursion and plans to, you know, to provoke Palestinians at Al-Aqsa and the Dome of the Rock has been just, I mean, every once in a while, like I am shocked at the level of absolute racist fanaticism that we see, but it's not surprising. You know, I'm like, how can this still be happening? Where just today, we saw mobs of young Israeli settler, you know, right wing Zionist nationalist youth chanting "Death to Arabs" and, you know, promising a second Nakba. And being completely egged on and emboldened by politicians in Israel and these like heads of the most fanatical settler movements that we've seen. It is all designed to once again to make life completely miserable for Palestinians. I mean, the Zionist plan has always been to push Palestinians to the brink so that they just give up and leave. Whether it's what Ilan Pappe calls a slow motion genocide, right? You have violent attacks where people are literally being killed. That's literal, you know, violent genocide. And then you have the kind of, slow motion incremental genocide, which is, the ethnic cleansing operations of making life so miserable that Palestinians just get up and leave. And, you know, we've seen that over the last few years in Sheikh Jarrah, where Palestinians are literally being kicked out of their homes so that settlers can take them. It's not just happening in Sheikh Jarrah. Of course, it's happening all over Palestine, inside the West Bank and inside 48. I hope that it won't escalate into another war, because that always means more death and destruction for Palestinians. But Israel is not known for their restraint or their diplomacy or their adherence to international laws or certainly responsibilities toward justice. I think we're just watching it very closously.
David, these Al-Aqsa incursions, they seem pretty chaotic and ill-planned. I mean, are they really spontaneous, do you think, or is it part of a wider strategy?
This is a strategy which goes back 100 years or more. I mean, in 1929, for example, there was a huge incident in Hebron, which was provoked by attempts by radical Zionists to try and access Al-Aqsa. And this has been going on since then. So, yes, it's a strategy, back 100 years at least. But, of course, more recently, there is a strategy to completely undermine the Al-Aqsa Mosque itself. There is archaeological digging, alleged archaeological digging underneath the Western Wall and under Al-Aqsa. And there are these incursions which are planned by settler groups. You may have seen on social media some of the photographs of Orthodox settlers with young goats in plastic bags trying to smuggle them into Al-Aqsa to sacrifice them on Passover. Now, that's a plan which comes from something called the Temple Institute, which is based just nearby and is funded by the Israeli government. And it wants to replace Al-Aqsa altogether with what's called the Third Temple. So this is an actual attempt that's been going on for over 100 years to simply remove Al-Aqsa, one of the key sites in Islam and in the religion.
Okay, yeah. Well, we'll just pause the discussion there for a moment, and we've got another report now on the history and contemporary significance of Al-Quds Day, which is traditionally marked on the last Friday of Ramadan.
Al-Quds Day is a global day of protest, of solidarity with the Palestinian struggle. It's commemorated on the last Friday of Ramadan. First announced by Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979 and first celebrated in 1980, Quds Day is a declaration of hostility to Zionism. Quds is known as Jerusalem by the Zionists. In Iran, it is routine for millions to attend Quds Day demonstrations in Tehran and other cities such as Qom. Hezbollah organizes large demonstrations in Lebanon, and there are events in Iraq, Jordan, and Syria. Similar demonstrations have taken place across the world, including in Nigeria, South Africa, and elsewhere. In Western nations like France, Sweden, Austria, Germany, the UK, and even the US and Canada, Quds Day has become an annual fixture. Zionist groups in the UK routinely smear the event as anti-Semitic. They're joined by the German-Israeli Friendship Society, which has smeared the Berlin demonstration. In Canada, Quds Day is denounced by the Zionist B'nai B'rith group, and in the US by the Zionist lobby group, the Anti-Defamation League. The hardline US-based neoconservative group, United Against Nuclear Iran, has condemned the event. Quds Day attracts strong negative attention from the Zionists and their supporters everywhere. Perhaps this is because of its militant character and support for resistance in Palestine. Unfortunately for them, Palestine has worldwide support, and the calls for solidarity with Palestine and indeed for the liberation of Palestine by the resistance will only grow stronger.
As you know, David, Quds Day gets a lot of criticism, I think, because it originated as a result of the Iranian Revolution. But do you think it has any wider significance other than drawing the inevitable opprobrium from the Zionists?
Yeah, it has significance because of its militant character, as the film there, I think, demonstrated. So it's a Palestine solidarity event which doesn't shirk from saying that we support the resistance in Palestine. And that, of course, is the only way that Palestine will be liberated. And so it's a kind of icon of the movement that people would be involved in supporting it. Yes, of course, it's attacked by the Zionist movement wherever it is celebrated. And that's a sign, really, that it is doing its job, that they are seeing it as a threat. They don't demonstrate against other sorts of pro-Palestinian activity. And so that's a key sign that Quds Day is really quite an important event and something which could be more significant in the years to come.
I mean, Quds Day is being marked internationally, isn't it, this year, and more widely, I think, than ever before. What would your advice be to supporters of Palestine liberation? How should they respond to these events that are taking place?
I think that the movement, Palestine Solidarity Movement, it's often called in the UK and other Western countries, needs to take its line really from the situation in Palestine. And that means celebrating and marking the importance of resistance inside Palestine against the Zionist entity, and indeed more widely against Zionism around the world. Zionist movements exist in Western countries all around the world as well. And it's important also then to not just to demonstrate in support of or in solidarity with Palestine, but also to think about how in the countries that people are in, that they start to think about dismantling the Zionist movement in the UK, in the US, in Canada, or wherever else they are.
Mm. I mean, what do you think people could do in this country in terms of, you know, supporting Palestinian resistance? I mean, you know, we hear about Palestine Action. I mean, what do you think Palestine, you know, resistance in this country should actually look like?
Well, Palestine Action is a good model. We've had them on this program before and discussed that issue. It's a good model. More people can, if they can get involved in that kind of thing, and there are many things you can do to support it, in addition to the kind of direct action, that's fantastic. Quds Day in this country is a demonstration. It could be a bigger demonstration. People should go along. It's on in a few days' time, on a Sunday, I think. So that there's an important sense there. But I think also, I think this applies not just in the UK, in this country, but in other Western countries too. We should be looking to find ways to end the Zionist movement in this country as well as to stand in solidarity with the struggle of the resistance in Palestine. And that means dismantling Zionist organizations or encouraging them to become de-Zionized, that is, to revert to being Jewish organizations rather than pro-Israel organizations.
Mm. I mean, what do you think that the focal point should be then? I mean, obviously you talk about Palestine Action. I mean, they're sort of targeting factories. I mean, there's that. I mean, should we be targeting the Israeli embassy as well? What's your thoughts?
The more we demonstrate against the Israeli embassy, the better. But there are also, of course, hundreds of Zionist organizations in this country. Some of them are charities, some of them are companies. These kinds of organizations need to be targeted too, not just factories that make arms, but the organizations which are sending money directly to the settlements in Palestine. These are the organizations which need to be pointed out, targeted, perhaps occupied, and in the end, shut down.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there now because we've unfortunately run out of time. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
April 25th happened to be the 42nd anniversary of the miracle in the desert of Tabas in east-central Iran that dashed all American hopes of superiority when the great Satan tried to launch a surprise attack on the nascent Islamic Republic through a well-planned operation codenamed Eagle Claw. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading, The American Eagle Permanently Declawed. Here's the story. The forces of oppression, tyranny, atheism, polytheism, and all other vices that are opposed to the one and only Creator and the principle of divine justice are a vanishing lot and sooner or later will be a thing of the past, as was the case with the all evil powers. The U.S. regime claims to be world's paramount military power equipped with the largest number of nuclear weapons. It boasts of being the number one economy. It brags about its mastery of science and technology that enables it to explore outer space and control cyberspace. It gulls over its media stranglehold, and yet it is a helpless and impotent entity destined to be doomed, especially when it dares to confront those that are divinely blessed. April 25th happened to be the 42nd anniversary of the miracle in the desert of Tabas in east-central Iran that dashed all American hopes of superiority when the great Satan tried to launch a surprise attack on the nascent Islamic Republic through a well-planned operation codenamed Eagle Claw. In the dead of night, while the unsuspecting Iranian people were asleep with complete trust in the protective power of God Almighty, in obedience to whom they had staged the Islamic Revolution to overthrow the British-installed Pahlavi regime and kick out the American hegemons from their sacred soil, President Jimmy Carter made the self-destructive move to try to reclaim control of Iran through the highly trained Delta Force. A total of 8 U.S. Navy RH-53D helicopters took off from the aircraft carrier Nimitz, which was positioned in the Arabian Sea and were joined by 6 C-130 Hercules aircraft that had been stationed at a military base in Oman to land on a remote airstrip some 350 kilometers from Tehran for the final swoop on the Iranian capital to capture or kill the Iranian leadership with the help of some turncoats and free the 52 detained American spies. God Almighty is the best of planners, and he decided to show a glimpse of his signs when he decreed particles of sand to rise as high as 10,000 feet in the air in the form of a dense white cloud, swirling, whirling, and twirling around an airborne U.S. invasion force to reduce machines to wreckage and their crew to charred bodies. Thus, April 25th is a Thanksgiving day for Iran and the Iranian people. Today, when the U.S. is suffering all sorts of defeats throughout the world, we are indeed grateful to the Almighty for preserving the power and prestige of the Islamic Republic. We thank God for helping us to achieve peace, stability, honor, dignity, independence, self-sufficiency, industrial progress, scientific breakthrough, technological development, and above all, the moral and ethical advancement in Iran. We also express our gratitude in the Divine Court for having inspired the people in the region and beyond to assert their independence and strive for the welfare of their respective nations, as well as the collective dignity of Islam and Muslims, as is evident by the developments of the past 4 decades. Examples galore, such as infusing of the spirit of Intifada in the Palestinian people, the rise of the legendary anti-terrorist movement Hezbollah in Lebanon, the victory of the people of Syria over the most macabrely murderous terrorist, the establishment of independent Iraq, the emergence of the popular Ansarullah movement in Yemen, the awakening of the long oppressed people of Bahrain, and last but not the least, the resurgence of the Nigerian people led by Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. Many more freedom movements are in the embryonic stage and will definitely triumph in the near future, thanks to divine assistance in the permanent declining of the American eagle and, consequently, the impending doom awaiting all other vultures preying on oppressed people.
Insight. Good evening and welcome to this episode of Insight. It is 60 years now that the U.S. has imposed economic sanctions on Cuba. We will be discussing this issue and other issues related to Cuba in a conversation with Alberto González Casals, Cuba's ambassador to Iran. But first, this brief analysis.
We recently witnessed the large amount of sanctions that the US and Europe imposed on Russia following its invasion of Ukraine. We're also very familiar with the US and Western sanctions that have been imposed on Iran in the last 43 years following the Islamic Revolution that overthrew the US-backed Pahlavi dictatorship in Iran. However, many forget that this year it will be 60 years that the US has imposed an embargo and economic sanctions on Cuba following the Cuban Revolution that overthrew the US-backed Batista dictatorship in that island nation. If we look at history, we see that the conflict between Cuba and the US did not begin with the Cuban Revolution, but goes back to the beginnings of the United States and the Monroe Doctrine, which declared the Western Hemisphere to be America's sphere of influence or backyard, and that the US would not tolerate foreign powers being present in that region, declaring this mainly to European colonial states which had colonies in the Americas. This was particularly true of the island of Cuba, which was a Spanish colony located less than 100 miles from the US mainland. From the very beginning of the United States, plans for the conquest or purchase of Cuba from Spain were made in various administrations. During the time preceding the American Civil War, southern slave states made efforts to stoke war with Spain in order to annex Cuba and add it to the list of slave states at a time when new states in the American West were being added to the US territory, most of which were free, non-slave states. Finally, in 1898, the imperialist factions in the US were successful in igniting a war with Spain. Following Spain's defeat, the US formally declared Cuba to be a US protectorate, as well as receiving Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines from Spain. The United States granted Cuba the appearance of independence in 1902, but imposed a constitution on Cuba that gave power over Cuban foreign and economic affairs to the United States, and even gave the US the right to intervene militarily at its own discretion, which it did on numerous occasions, including the occupation of the famous Guantanamo Bay, in which the US maintains a naval base, and which is the notorious site of the illegal detention and torture of hundreds of people that the US has kidnapped in its so-called War on Terror since 2001. This was followed by years of the United States backing the Batista dictatorship, in which Cuba became the center of criminal activities of the American mafia, particularly money laundering, gambling, and prostitution, where the Batista regime was paid off from the profits of these criminal activities in order for the mafia to continue these activities. Following the revolution, the Cuban government, under the leadership of Fidel Castro, sided with the Soviet Union in the Cold War, leading to the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 and Cuba's active involvement in many wars of liberation and decolonization in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, further enraging US leaders. If the US excuse to impose sanctions on Cuba throughout the Cold War was Cuba's backing of the Soviet Union, the continuation of the sanctions after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and its continuation until today by every US administration, shows that maybe the real reason for the imposition of US sanctions has always been that US elites want to punish Cubans for their independence and to let this serve as a warning to other nations in Latin America and around the world who would want to follow this example. Despite the countless assassinations, coup d'etats, and dirty tricks that the United States conducted throughout the world, it has for 60 years miserably failed to overthrow the Cuban Revolution, and Cubans have been able to reach high levels of human development and are now among the most advanced nations in medicine and biotechnology, and among the few nations who successfully developed their own line of COVID vaccines despite these sanctions, which deprive Cuba of its largest natural market for its products and services. Given the rapidly changing global environment and the powerful non-Western and anti-US alliances that are forming in the 21st century,
it might become easier for Cuba to exist as an independent, revolutionary nation in the next 60 years, in a future where it will matter less if the U.S. imposes or does not impose sanctions on a nation, even a nation that is located so close to the United States.
Ambassador Casals, thank you very much for joining us on Insight. As you know, the program tries to look at the issues from a historic and strategic perspective. We have taken the occasion of the 60 years of U.S. sanctions on Cuba to have a conversation with you today about the history of Cuba, about the different things that are happening there in Cuba and in the region in Latin America, but also Cuba's relations with Iran. And we would like to ask you to please share some of your insight into these matters. And before we get to the historic issues, let's start talking about the sanctions. So, as you know, Iran has been sanctioned for 43 years. We were, until very recently, the world champions of American sanctions. This is now, this honor has now been given to the Russians. They are now starting to get it. But the country that has been the most sanctioned in history is Cuba for 60 years. Some might say that it is not worth the trouble for the independence. Some countries want to be independent. They are willing to accept sanctions. Some countries, no, they don't care. They will do what the Americans say and get all the different consumer products that they think the people want. So I would like to ask you in this way. Is it worth it to suffer under the sanctions and have independence? Or is it better to do what the Americans say and have all the consumer products that you want?
Yes, of course. Thank you so much, my friend, to having me in your program. And thank you so much to Press TV, to all your teams, for this opportunity to address to the audience, to the Press TV. Regarding the sanction, as you say, of course, Cuba, we have the number one sanction from the United States. Only in the last period of this person named Trump in the United States, they got only 244 measures against Cuba, sanctions against Cuba. They get the worst situation for Cuba and the worsening in this moment. We don't have difference now in this moment with the Biden administrations that's supposed to be as another kind of administration. They will change something in Cuba or regarding Cuba or toward Cuba, but nothing changed by the moment. We said more or less that it could be in the same situation we have. And the people of Cuba are suffering, of course, and our economy is suffering in a very hard situations because of the sanctions. There is no any sector, there is no any situations regarding Cuba that is not affected by the sanctions from the United States. Not even no family, no person, even living in Cuba or living overseas, is not affected by the sanctions. All of us are affected one way to another one by the sanctions. Mainly, and the more hard and sensitive, is regarding the medicines and the sector of medicines and the health sector, of course, and affected most a lot. Personally, I have my own experience that one family of mine died because of we cannot get in the proper way one medicines from the lab from the United States. They denied, due to the law of the embargo, to facilitate these medicines to the Cuban people. And so my personal way, I need to suffer a loss from in my family. And like me, many people in Cuba, we have many situations regarding the health sector, the food sector, I mean agricultural sector, because anything is under sanctions on Cuba. Even if you import any kind of goods that have at least 10%, only 10%, building in America, this is under sanction for these situations. And as you said, but we have 60 years in these conditions, and it's getting run, and we will continue in that situation if they don't want. It's not Cuba who blocked the United States. It's not Cuba who affect the economy of the United States. It's not Cuba who make a sanction to the United States and nobody in the United States. So it's not in our size, the solutions. They need to get conscious about it and to get, this is old politics, this is obsolete politics, this is illegal politics that they toward to us. Of course, the sanctions from the United States isn't only because of the United States. It's because of there is some people too, or some countries that support the United States in many ways. So the United States not only can't put the sanctions because it could be almost impossible to guard in the economy, a global economy, but in the people follow the conditions from the sanctions in the United States, of course, affect to us in the same way. We will continue, of course. It's more important for us, the moral that we have in front of the world. We are a hope. We resist, and we will continue to resist. We have 60 years, we will have 60 years more. If they want to continue to do it, it's their own problem. They affected too, not only the Cuban people, they affected too the American people. They prohibit, even against your own law, prohibit the American to visit Cuba. Cuba is the only country by law in the United States that they cannot visit. Even they could visit, American could visit any place that they could be dangerous and pay place like war or something like that. But Cuba, only 90 miles from the coast of the United States, they cannot visit Cuba.
A lot of families.
At least legally point of view. And the point of view of the family too. They affect to the family, the Cuban family that living in the United States and the Cuban family. They divide the families of the Cuban family there. That's, and they don't take care about that. They have emptied their embassy in Havana. We still have the relationship. We promote the normal relationship between Cuba and the government of the United States. But even they quit the consulate. The American consulate in Havana is practically not working in this moment. So the Cuban people need to go to so far like Guyana or some another place to obtain the consular topics and consular procedures to get to the United States and to get the visa. After that, staying there in Guyana, in many ways, they deny the visa for the Cubans who went there. And so the Cuban people, sometimes they get illegally entered into the United States. They promote the legal way to get migrations to the United States. They broke the talks that we have in migration topics that it affected in this kind of way. And later than that, they condemn us because the people want to go to the United States due to the situations in Cuba. So they block us. They make a sanction to our economy. They don't allow the normal people to make the consular affair. They make a lot of things against Cuba and the Cuban people. Then they decide this is an internal problem. So it's not because of that. It's because it is the American that they consider that they are the police in the world, and they not consider to have in the proper way the normal behavior of the neighbor. We want a normal relationship with the United States, but not under conditions and with all respect to our sovereignty. And answer your question, of course, we will continue to resist until this moment.
Well, it's very interesting, Mr. Ambassador, because you raised the issue of having normal relations like any other neighbor. But if we look at history, America has never had normal relations with its neighbors, and particularly with Cuba. Mm-hmm. Because you talk about America being police. Long before it wanted to be the police of the world, it was the police of Cuba and Latin America and Central America. For our viewers who might not be familiar with the history, let's talk a little bit about the history. If you look at the history, we see that Cuba, unlike many other countries in Latin America, remained a Spanish colony longer than a lot of other countries. And it had very stronger ties with Spain than some of the other countries. And it was after the Spanish-American War that, although there were independence movements in Cuba in the 19th century, actual independence occurred after the Spanish-American War, which was the end of the 19th century. And immediately America turns Cuba into a protectorate.
Yes.
It forced a constitution onto Cuba that gave the America a right to intervene into Cuba whenever it wanted to, like in Panama. Later on, when they separated Panama from Colombia, and also Guantanamo Bay occupies till today occupying Guantanamo Bay with all the crimes and all the torture and all the illegal detention that's going on there.
And also controlling the, basically controlling the foreign policy and the economic policy of Cuba.
Yes.
In the first half of the 20th century. So please explain for our viewers, those who are not familiar with the history, who might not be from Latin America. The history is not simply that, you know, the government in Cuba is communist and the Americans are capitalist. It is actually an imperialist struggle. It is, even if Cuba was not communist, the Americans would be doing the same thing. Yes. So if you could please explain a little bit the history of what's going on with America.
Yes, of course. Let me tell you first that the